Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a reality TV president teasing upcoming episodes of The Apprentice in the Oval Office by cryptically warning about the calm before the storm, then tweeting that only one thing will work with North Korea, implying military action. Mark Fitzpatrick, the executive director of the Washington-based America's Office of the International Institute for Strategic Studies and head of their Nonproliferation and Nuclear Policy Program and author of Asia's Latent Nuclear Powers, Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan, joins us to discuss how Trump's threats are forcing Kim Jong-un into a hair-trigger posture with North Korea's nuclear weapons based on the use-them-or-lose-them logic of striking first. We'll examine the symbiosis of hawks on both sides, leading us into a Holocaust and the dangers of provoking a cult-like regime whose hardliners are buoyed by delusional propaganda and the belief that they could not only survive a nuclear war with the United States, but win. Then we'll get an update on the investigation into the Trump campaign's ties to Russia and speak with investigative journalist James Henry, the co-founder of DCReport.org and a global justice fellow at Yale and the lead researcher for the Tax Justice Network. He joins us to discuss the significance of the special counsel's interviews with the author of the Steele dossier and Robert Mueller's focus on the Trump campaign's use of data mining in social media and micro-targeting voters in key swing states, with the possible magnification of their messaging involving help from Russian bots and troll farms. Then finally, we'll examine the consequences of the Trump administration's reversal of the Obamacare contraceptive mandate, which will now allow employers to deny their female employees contraceptive coverage under health plans on the specious basis of a moral objection. Frances Kissling, a feminist activist and the former president of Catholics for Choice and a consultant to the Western Hemisphere region of the International Planned Parenthood Federation, joins us to discuss how employers can now save money by claiming to have a moral objection to birth control, which will likely result in many more women seeking abortions. And joining us now is Mark Fitzpatrick, executive director of the Washington-based America's Office of the International Institute for Strategic Studies, where he heads the IISS Nonproliferation and Nuclear Policy Program, focusing on proliferation challenges and on nuclear security and nuclear disarmament issues. He's the author of Asia's Latent Nuclear Powers, Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan, Overcoming Pakistan's Nuclear Dangers, and the Iranian Nuclear Crisis, Avoiding Worst-Case Outcomes. He is the editor of six IISS strategic dossiers on countries and regions of proliferation concerns, most recently on North Korea and Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Fitzpatrick.
Well, thanks for inviting me. Happy to talk to you.
Well, thank you, Mark. There seems to be a symbiosis in a way between hawks on both sides in terms of a possible confrontation between the United States and North Korea. I was just reading the piece in the New York Times on Sunday. Nicholas Kristof was on a visit to North Korea, given a rare opportunity, and the foreign ministry handlers basically had to protect them or closet the American visitors from hardliners. They're apparently been kind of, well, they've got some wind at their back. Not only do they feel war is inevitable, they think the North Koreans can actually win even a nuclear war. So that was an alarming situation. But the president himself, the other day, he said at a dinner with military leaders, he said, cryptically remarked about the calm before the storm. And then subsequent to that, he tweeted out, there's only one thing that will work with dealing with North Korea, implying a military option. So are you alarmed?
I am alarmed. You know, I have a tendency to dismiss what Donald Trump says as the ravings of an uncoordinated, ill-informed leader whose cabinet is trying to restrain him and certainly would not launch the kind of military action that he's hinting at. But the huge danger in his remarks is that the North Koreans misperceive it as the beginning of an attack. And that Nicholas Kristof article was absolutely terrifying in the manner in which he described all the North Koreans he met as almost itching for war themselves. no comprehension, or at least no willingness to acknowledge that the war would bring a huge devastation to their country. It would last a very short amount of time, but there would be huge destruction and death on both sides before it was over. And both President Trump and the North Koreans don't seem to understand what's the next step in this rhetorical war of words that they're engaged in.
Well, you could make the case that we are very lucky to have survived the Cold War without a nuclear exchange, and the Abel Archer incident in 1983 would indicate how frail and fragile that nuclear peace was. And it was all about perceptions. The gerontocracy in the Kremlin started to believe what Ronald Reagan was talking about, you know, that they'll end up on the ash heap of history. They, of course, there was no distinction between rhetoric and reality in the Soviet Union, so they took those words seriously, and we almost stumbled into a nuclear war in November of 1983. So this would be, to my mind, would be worse, because we know that the North Korean regime is kind of like a cult, a religious cult. And as Christoph's visit indicates in his article in Sunday's New York Times, they thought they won the Korean War, and they think they'll not only survive a nuclear war with the United States, but they'll win a nuclear war with the United States. So this is, let me ask you, do you think this is worse in a way, more dangerous than the triggers that could have set off a nuclear war with the Soviet Union?
It's worse in some ways, and it's not as worse in other ways. And the ways in which it's not as worse is that North Korea has a small nuclear arsenal. It may not be able to hit American cities with a nuclear-armed missile today. Next year, probably will have that capability. And you know, and the Soviet Union had hundreds of thousands of ICBMs that could target the United States. So the relative order of battle is quite different. But what makes it more scary is the potential for misperception is higher, because North Korea, being more of a closed state, its leaders knowing little about the world, and so the potential for misunderstanding Donald Trump's tweets is higher.
Well, that, of course, is the issue, is perception. And we, of course, consider ourselves virtuous, and we don't recognize that the other side may not see us the same way. But isn't there... Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, there's another way that makes it more dangerous, and that is that during the Cold War, there was a mutually assured destruction status, that neither side felt that it had to start a war in order to win it, that they could survive the other side's first strike and they would have a second strike capability. There was a strategic stability in the manner in which the United States and the Soviet Union faced off against one another. That's not the case with North Korea. North Korea does not have a second strike capability. So if they are attacked by the United States in a preventive war to destroy their missiles and nuclear weapons, the United States might not get them all, probably wouldn't get them all in the first salvo, but North Korea may be left without a second strike capability. So it has an incentive to strike first, not to wait. And that's the real danger, why this is a more scary situation than that time with Abel Archer in the Cold War.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Fitzpatrick, who's Executive Director of the Washington-based America's Office of the International Institute for Strategic Studies, where he heads the IISS Non-Proliferation and Nuclear Policy Program, focusing on proliferation challenges and on nuclear security and nuclear disarmament issues. He's the author of Asia's Latent Nuclear Powers, Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan, Overcoming Pakistan's Nuclear Dangers, and the Iranian Nuclear Crisis, Avoiding Worst-Case Outcomes. So October the 10th, which is Tuesday, is North Korea's Foundation Day, one of its two major national holidays. It's reasonable, isn't it, Mark Fitzpatrick, to predict or at least expect some kind of gesture like a nuclear, no, I don't know about a nuclear test, but they did threaten to fire a H-bomb over the Pacific, but a missile launch, do you think that would happen? Could that be a trigger?
I think there is a real possibility that North Korea will test another missile on October 10th. They don't always test their missiles on politically significant days, although they often try to do so on American holidays. The timing of the test is not certain, but the fact that North Korea is preparing to test another ICBM range missile is pretty clear. There was a recent visitor to North Korea, a former Russian diplomat who came back with that word. So I think we can expect another long-range North Korean missile test in the coming weeks. It may be as soon as October 10th, but it will be coming. And in light of President Trump's words, he's implicitly threatening to do something when North Korea readies that missile for launch. Maybe he's implicitly declaring that he will act to destroy the missile on the launch pad before it can be launched. That would be an act of war, of course. It would be a preventive attack. If he could get away with it without further North Korean response and retaliation, then that would be fine. But the likely North Korean response is going to come in the form of a very sharp response against Seoul, probably, maybe against U.S. facilities in South Korea, maybe even against U.S. bases in Japan. So it would be a very risky move, and that's what we have to worry about in the upcoming weeks.
Well, it's my understanding that the adult supervision, if you will, around Trump, Generals Mattis, McMaster, and Kelly, and I suppose to some extent Rex Tillerson, although he apparently is somewhat on the outs at the moment, the idea that they can restrain him or can convince him about what's really happening in the real world may be a pretty thin reed that we're resting on, because they keep saying there are adults in the room. Well, we're not sure that they are in the room at all the time, particularly when Trump tweets out these threatening tweets, as he did with North Korea, the only thing that'll work in dealing with North Korea implying a military option. So what's your sense then of that? Because I'm told that on a regular basis, they have to talk Trump down. He keeps wanting to do something militarily, and they keep trying to tell him that there aren't any military options. And then he comes back at them again, trying to find a way to hit back at North Korea. And as you said earlier, if all they have is a first-strike capability without the delivery necessarily of being able to put a nuclear weapon on a missile, there are other ways you can deliver nuclear weapons to the United States, on a fishing trawler, for example. So if they think that they have to use them or lose them, as they say, wouldn't that mean that they might even be preparing some kind of means to deliver nuclear weapons to the American homeland?
So there's a lot we can talk about here. One is whether adults in the room could restrain Trump from launching a war. And I think you're right that they have talked him down. But there is a lot of talk in Washington about such a preventive war. And there are some responsible people, pundits, who are suggesting that it's a risk worth taking, that we don't know exactly how North Korea would respond. And Senator Lindsey Graham said something outrageous a couple months ago, that if a war was sparked, it would happen over there, meaning in the Far East, not over here in the United States. So the deaths and destruction wouldn't be met on the U.S. homeland. But you know, that ignores the fact that America has tens of thousands of troops in South Korea and Japan, and hundreds of thousands of citizens who would be in the line of fire. So whether the war erupts there or here, it would be devastating. North Korea's response won't necessarily be to attack the United States. And I think the idea of nuclear weapons loaded on a barge or a boat or something is probably fanciful. But they can threaten U.S. bases in Japan. You know, they've been testing missiles that certainly can strike all U.S. bases in Japan. And these are well-tested missiles, the Nodong. So there's no doubt that they can meet the target. There is some doubt about whether North Korea can miniaturize a nuclear warhead and get it to explode properly. But that's not that hard of technology, and most analysts believe that North Korea can do that. So the use them or lose them scenario that's most likely is that in the event of a preventive attack on a North Korean missile on a launch pad or some other military attack, that North Korea may use its nuclear weapons against U.S. bases in Japan or against the port of Busan, which is the entry point for if U.S. forces were to flow in to reinforce a war effort there. And this is all, you know, horribly destructive, you know, attacks that we're talking about, whether or not it can hit the U.S. mainland.
Well, he's already deployed a weapon of mass destruction, Kim Jong-un, against his own half-brother. And prior to that, of course, he killed his uncle. In both cases, the uncle was close to the Chinese leadership, and the older half-brother was under the protection of the Chinese. And I think in many ways, Kim Jong-un is more afraid of the Chinese than he is of the Americans. But he did, in the case of his killing, his assassinating his older half-brother, he used a binary form of, I think it was sarin, was it, or VX?
It was a VX agent.
VX, right. So that, of course, if they would have stockpiles of VX, wouldn't they? And that could create panic in Seoul, for example.
This is another way that Kim Jong-un, apart from nuclear weapons, has very destructive means of retaliation. And I believe that the reason he went to the lengths of using a chemical agent to assassinate his elder brother, when there are so many other ways one could do that, when why use a VX agent? I think it was to show the world that he had VX agents, that he has chemical weapons, and that it adds to North Korea's deterrence to try to fend off a U.S. attack. In the event of a war, I think those chemical weapons would be used in artillery shells sent into populated areas of South Korea. Half of South Korea's population lives in the greater metropolitan area of Seoul, which is quite close to the demilitarized zone with North Korea, and thus vulnerable to strikes by the North. So these are all reasons why it is so risky to talk about a preventive war against North Korea, because even talking about it makes the already paranoid leadership in North Korea be prone to misjudge and misperceive actions that the United States might take.
But already, I think Donald Trump has elevated the North. I think the best way to deal with this failed state, the tyranny of the weak, is to ignore them. And this fellow really wants attention, and he gets attention in the way that a juvenile delinquent gets attention. So instead of starving him of attention, Trump has elevated him to the number one player on the world stage. And in many ways, he's elevated him in a way where he's the victim and where the victimizers. I mean, he's completely turned the tables.
Well, he certainly has elevated Kim Jong-un's stature and made him the equivalent. You know, one of North Korea's repeated desires is to engage in arms control talks with the United States as an equal nuclear armed power. Now, the United States is not going to do that. But in this war of words, the United States has certainly played into Kim Jong-un's hands by treating him as an equal in terms of a nuclear armed loudmouth. Now, in terms of North Korea's perception around the world, so far it's not gotten to the point where too many countries or foreigners believe that North Korea is the victim. But certainly, if there was a war started as a so-called preventive war in which the United States sought to remove a missile on the launch pad that was not being aimed to attack the United States, it was just being aimed as a test launch, then in that case, North Korea would have the sympathy of many people around the world who would see the United States as having started an unnecessary war.
Well, just in closing, we sort of run out of time, and the other possibility is some kind of confrontation with Iran, and there's an expectation that Donald Trump is going to break the Iran deal before the UN, he said it was a terrible deal, and of course it was done during the Obama administration, and he has this obsession about undoing anything that Obama did. Just in closing, is it possible that that's the storm that he's talking about, that we're now in the calm before that storm? Is it more likely to be North Korea?
You know, I think he's talking about two storms. I'm thinking of the image of United States territories being hit by two hurricanes this past season, actually three if you count the one that hit Puerto Rico. The Iran storm is a slower moving storm in a way. President Trump's likely action these coming days is not to break the deal, but to decertify it. And by doing so, hope to put pressure on Iran and get them to renegotiate, which is a very far off hope. But the signals are that he doesn't want to break the deal. He wants to use it for leverage. And it's too clever by half, because it then gives the power to the U.S. Senate whether or not to break the deal. It gives them a fast-track legislative process for reimposing sanctions that were waived as part of this deal. And if Congress does what it had been talking of doing, it will impose sanctions, and then that could lead to breaking the deal. So that would be storm number one, and then the North Korea case, a much bigger storm. So it's not looking good for advocates of peace, of advocates of diplomatic solutions to troublesome proliferation questions. If Trump were to break the deal with Iran, it would certainly signal to North Korea that there's no point in even reaching a deal with the United States if it's not going to be lived up to, even though Iran, in this case, is fully adhering to the deal.
Well, Mark Fitzpatrick, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Quite happy to talk to you. Thanks for asking me.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Fitzpatrick, who's Executive Director of the Washington-based America's Office of the International Institute for Strategic Studies, where he heads the IISS Nonproliferation and Nuclear Policy Program, focusing on proliferation challenges and on nuclear security and nuclear disarmament issues. He's the author of Asia's Latent Nuclear Powers, Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan, Overcoming Pakistan's Nuclear Dangers, and The Iranian Nuclear Crisis, Avoiding Worst-Case Outcomes.
And we're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back with an update on the investigation into Trump's campaigns, the Trump campaign's ties to Russia.
Mother, do you think they'll drop the bomb? Mother, do you think they'll like this song?
Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist who's written extensively about global banking, debt crises, tax havens, and economic development. He is a Global Justice Fellow at Yale University and the co-founder with David K. Johnson of the new investigative reporting news service, dcreport.org, and is the author of Blood Bankers. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Henry.
Good to be with you.
Well, thank you, James. And I want to talk to you about this Dutch documentary that's played in the Netherlands. You're a part of it. They seem to be doing some very important investigative work on what the special counsel Mueller is up to. But let's talk about what we know here in the U.S. Obviously, Donald Trump wants to distract us all from this inquiry, whether it's making a phony issue out of standing for the national anthem at football games. And of course, we've been distracted by natural disasters, hurricanes in Texas, Florida, and in Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands. But what's sort of gone under the radar a little bit is that we've just learned recently that Mueller, in fact, has met with the author of the Steele dossier, the former MI6 intelligence officer. Apparently, they met last summer, I believe. We also have learning now Kaspersky Labs may have been involved in stealing top-secret NSA
hacking tools that ended up on the web. We also learned the Manhattan District Attorney dropped felony fraud investigation against Ivanka Trump and Donald Trump Jr. back in 2012 because Trump's lawyer, Mark Kasowitz, made a hefty campaign donation to Cyrus Vance Jr., the Manhattan DA. What else is happening here in terms of the worm slowly turning?
Well, I think the most important stuff that I've been working with the Dutch public television networks on and other kind of international investigative journalists is to actually track the proceeds of kleptocrats and people basically stolen money from their governments in places like Kazakhstan back into Trump projects and properties. And so the documentary you mentioned came out a couple weeks ago and, you know, is available on YouTube. It basically documents, I think, for the first time, the actual criminal origins of actual money that was being invested by Trump's own business partners. People who are themselves convicted of felonies, you know, Trump, if he didn't know that they were felons, it's hard to believe. And that amounts to a kind of concealment fraud. So, you know, in addition to the tampering with the 2016 elections that Mueller is investigating, there is this other whole theory of the case, which is that, you know, Trump is really a kind of mobster, and he's been associated with all kinds of criminal elements and people who've been sending money from, especially from Russia and the former Soviet Union states like Kazakhstan, into his investments over the last couple decades. I think that's a theory that Mueller ought to be looking at, and I understand that he is.
Well, there seems to be so many threads to this, and it does indicate if you kind of try to aggregate all of the investigations going on, whether it's the Steele dossier, whether it's the Facebook Russian ads, whether it's the 21 states that Russian intelligence probed in cyber attacks, particularly three or four of the key swing states. Overall, you get the bigger picture of a large, coordinated and concerted Russian intelligence operation. At least that's the way I see it. And, you know, Putin knows exactly what happened. From his perspective, he's got the full picture because he orchestrated it. But it seems to me that the special counsel is trying to put that picture together, piece of mosaic, one at a time, filling in. And where would you say?
I think the most the other thing that's you know, coming to light is all of this use of facial, you know, sort of Facebook and other social media, Twitter, to actually try to get fake news stories to a carefully selected section of the electorate. As many as 10 million Americans, especially in swing states like Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, actually got these kind of private messages from Facebook. And, you know, we know that there were millions of these things. Maybe at least half of them were sent before the election. We don't know. I mean, Facebook has been fairly stingy with their, you know, revelations about the details. But, you know, it's clear that the Russians were involved in buying these social media. They had lots of bots involved in directing these things. And I doubt very much that they would have been doing all of this targeting of American voters, you know, on their own. There's companies like Cambridge Analytica, they're funded by Robert Mercer, in part, that got involved in the act. Bannon and company. Bannon was an official at that company for a while. Steve Bannon, the president's former advisor and still a big advocate for the alt-right. You know, so I think there's the ball is in Mueller's court here. The Congress is you know, hamstrung here in terms of being able to have a full-scale Watergate-type public investigation of this. And, you know, that's really hampering the public's right to know here. But I think Mueller is doing his job, and you know, soon enough we may have some indictments coming down for some of Trump's closest former associates.
And again, I'm speaking with James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist who's written extensively about global banking, debt crises, tax havens, and economic development. He is a Global Justice Fellow at Yale University and a senior fellow at Columbia University Center for Sustainable Development, and co-founder with David K. Johnson of the new investigative reporting news service, dcreport.org, and the author of Blood Bankers. Columbia University social media analyst, of course, has found that Russia propaganda could have been shared billions of times on Facebook, that it was a much bigger phenomenon. And you just pointed out that maybe the real focus of, or one of the many focuses of Mueller that he's zeroing in on, is the connection between Cambridge Analytica and the people who did the data mining and social media targeting for the Trump campaign. They, prior to that, they did Brexit, and they also recently did the Kenyan election that's now having to be done over. Senator Merkley, who's on the Intelligence Committee, just mentioned that, hinted that that was the real smoking gun. How would you rate it in comparison to the other threads of this investigation?
You know, there's so many different threads. I mean, there's kind of two basic theories. One is that the election tampering is the deal. I think that that is hard for journalists really to you know, finally pin down. It really does require people with subpoena power to get at the truth and with respect to all these various players. But the other theory of the case that I've emphasized here, I think, is terribly important, and that is just emphasizing the criminality that, you know, Trump is not so much a mole as a kind of a mob figure, and you know, willing to deal with all kinds of shady characters. And I think there is, you know, that kind of investigation has legs, and we're going to have some more revelations about that soon. So, you know, we're talking about lots of money pouring into Trump at just the right time from, you know, very dubious sources. You know, ultimately, the American people have got to decide whether they care about all this, and that is the issue. And it's apparently a lot of his supporters just don't. I mean, you know, he's famous for claiming that he could shoot somebody in broad daylight on Fifth Avenue and it wouldn't matter to his supporters. You know, I think at some level, and the support for impeachment is now somewhere around 42%. A lot of people are just, you know, his approval ratings are down in the, you know, the low 30s. But at some point, we have to have a Congress step forward and start to consider what to do about this, and that just is missing in action at the moment.
And since you're at Columbia University's Center for Sustainable Development, what do you know about this Columbia University social media study that found that Russian propaganda could have been shared by billions?
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of analysts out there. A fellow named Andrew McAfee, who's an investor in Facebook, recently called for a much more thorough disclosure by Facebook about what they know about all of the people who are receiving, you know, these messages. It just wasn't the first round of distribution that was important, because these things got replayed, as you say, many, many times. The question is what kind of impact they would have had on voters, and there we'd actually have to go out and, you know, ask the voters. That Facebook would have to identify the people who received these messages. And you'd have to go ask them, you know, what kind of impact. It's not easy to determine in retrospect, but, you know, I think there's a whole lot more to know about the actual, you know, size and sort of impact that these kinds of this kind of messaging had. There's no question that it's been done in other elections around the world. The same kind of tactics were used in Europe, you know, with some degree of success. But, you know, I think we're still in the investigation mode here, and Mueller has got the tools that he needs to get to the bottom of this.
But if you trace the story of the Steele dossier, and initially it was commissioned by a company called Fusion GPS in Washington, D.C., and the head of that testified for many, many hours before, I think, the Senate Select Committee, and presumably he's also talked to Robert Mueller. But
before it was ever came to light, it was the FBI were given a copy by Steele.
The FBI and the CIA both had copies.
Right, and I think the FBI paid Steele as well. And I think my understanding is he spent some time with FBI counterintelligence going over his sources. And so clearly, Comey knows an awful lot about this dossier and how credible it is.
Well, it's probably one of the reasons he was fired. I mean, there's a couple key claims in the Steele dossier. It's been it's controversial, but I mean, we haven't seen any of the tapes that were supposed to have been made. Those have just not showed up. And the other thing is about this oil company transaction where Trump was supposed to have been paid off for his cooperation. You know, some of us have questions about whether that would be the way anyone would get paid a bribe. But there are, a substantial number of specific allegations. And in fact, this oil transaction that he predicted as of June 2016 actually occurred in December 2016. So that is a basic fact that's hard to argue with. Mm-hmm. I think there's just so many opportunities here for a congressional investigation to really get to the bottom of this, but it is not, the Congress has shown no inclination. All of these, all this testimony you've been describing has been behind closed doors, unlike the Watergate back in 1973.
Sure. Well, so, but you mentioned a little while ago that you thought maybe the reason that Comey was fired was that he was very familiar with the Steele dossier apparently finds it very credible. It was the consensus of all of the American intelligence communities that Russia did indeed interfere. The FBI held out for a while, I believe, and then finally joined in the consensus. But as far as I know, it was Comey himself who took the Steele dossier, and briefed Trump himself with the dossier after having briefed President Obama. And this absolutely freaked out Trump. I mean, hearing about Russian hookers and all of the salacious stuff in it, on top of all of the incredibly explosive collusion that it alleges, and all the many aspects of Russian interference, including, helping the Green Party candidate Jill Stein in those three key states that Trump won narrowly. There's a whole bunch in it. So it would seem to me that Trump never got over that briefing, and you may well be right. He that's why he wanted a loyalty oath from Comey, and Comey didn't pass the test.
Well, it's pretty clear from the memos that he wrote the very weekend that he, decided to fire Comey, that he was thinking a lot more about Russia than, ended up in the final reasons that were given for the Comey firing. And that's one of the reasons Trump's memo on all that was of so great interest to Mueller, because one of the issues here is obstruction of justice. Did Comey get fired because the president wanted to close down this investigation? And he's going to have to make a determination about that. But if I were prosecuting this case, I think, that's one of the basic charges that you would look into seriously. Now, I think overall we are, the investigation is moldering along. We're really waiting for the next shoe to drop with the indictments that are probably in the works for some of Trump's closest people like Paul Manafort. And then we'll have to see what they actually knew. And I think that they knew a lot.
Well, there's already concern, and I believe Mueller has made movements to try and head off Trump's expected pardoning of key figures. What's your sense of how quickly can he pardon people before they spill the beans or before they get turned, flipped, as they say, by the special prosecutor?
It's an open area for, this is not an area where there's a lot of case law. It hasn't happened before. So the rights of the president to pardon someone who hasn't really been convicted. You know, it was just tried in this case in Arizona where we had the sheriff subject to a kind of pardon, even though he was, I don't think he'd been fully processed by the judicial system. You know, we're going to have to see what appetite the president has to, you know, basically do a kind of Saturday night special here and try to close down investigations. That has a history of getting Americans pretty upset. They like to see the judicial process work, and I think that may be, you know, he may be. Bannon already said that the Comey firing was one of the greatest mistakes that Trump had made. And the White House seems to be trying to collaborate with Mueller as far as possible on the investigation. They have my Harvard classmate Ty Cobb representing them in this case, and he's, you know, a very experienced kind of white-collar criminal lawyer who's trying to tell, you know, Trump just to calm down and you know, keep your powder dry. So, you know, I don't have any more wisdom than just, you know, let's see. Stay tuned. That's about it. This is at a critical time of the investigation. A lot's going on in the background, and, you know, I think pretty quickly we'll have some results from grand juries that Trump will have to respond to.
Well, I thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you.
And again, I've been speaking with James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist who's written extensively about global banking, debt crisis, tax havens, and economic development. He's a global justice fellow at Yale University and the co-founder with David K. Johnston of the new investigative reporting news service, dcreport.org, and the author of Blood Bankers. And we're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back with the Trump administration's reversal of the Obamacare contraceptive mandate. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Frances Kissling, a feminist activist and former president of Catholics for Choice. She's currently a visiting scholar at the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania and serves on the advisory boards of the Journal of Feminist Ethics and the Women's Bioethics Project. And she's a consultant to the Western Hemisphere region of the International Planned Parenthood Federation and writes a weekly column for Salon.com and blogs for ReligionDispatches.org. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frances Kissling.
Great to be with you.
Well, Frances, I wish we had some good news. I haven't been able to report good news for the longest time, I'm afraid. And obviously Donald Trump has this obsession with wanting to undo anything and everything that the Obama administration achieved. And the latest, of course, is his rolling back the contraceptive mandate under the Affordable Care Act. And it's already been sued, of course, by Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey and the Attorney General of the state of California, Javier Becerra. They're arguing, of course, that these new rules violate the First Amendment's Establishment Clause. But Paul Ryan, of course, is hailing it as a landmark day for religious liberty. I don't see how you can say that an employer can now refuse to give their employees contraception coverage based on moral objections. Morality is not a concept that the law recognizes, is it? The law and the Supreme Court recognize religion, but I don't believe they recognize morality, do they?
No. I mean, I think, first of all, as you note, it's an extremely ambiguous word. You know, there's no common agreement on what is moral or immoral in many cases, particularly when it comes to sexuality and reproduction. And so it's just open season for any employer, for IBM or whomever, to say, well, we don't feel like covering this in our insurance plan, and we're just going to claim that we object to it morally. And hundreds of thousands of women working for a very large employer can find themselves either without contraceptive coverage or having to pay for their contraceptives themselves. There's definitely nothing religious about morals clauses.
Well, of course, the religious groups have pushed for this change. The Little Sisters of the Poor being fairly prominent in this.
Right.
So, what is the explain that to again? Understand the religious part, but the moral part. It just seems like Trump and HHS under Trump have now given this huge open door to employers to basically save money, and any of them can say, "Wait, you know, I just have a moral objection to birth control."
Right. And the next thing they could say is that they have a moral objection to unmarried women having sex and becoming pregnant, and so they're not going to cover the birth of children of women who are not married. I mean, it opens the door in so many ways to regressive behavior and to the imposition of personal beliefs, not religious beliefs. But once you say that morality can handle this, then you're talking about every person's morality. One boss doesn't like contraception, another boss does, and so you'll have, you know, both a patchwork and a totally unreliable public policy for women over time. Well, and of course, the purpose of this is the main purpose of this is to give something to the Trump base. Again, especially to the religious, the conservative evangelical base that contributed to Trump's victory. And since he hasn't been able to deliver very much, hasn't been able to overturn the ACA, and so he's going to whittle away with it provision by provision.
And again, I'm speaking with Frances Kissling, who's a feminist activist and the former president of Catholics for Choice. She's currently a visiting scholar at the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania and serves on the advisory boards of the Journal of Feminist Ethics and the Women's Bioethics Project, and is a consultant to the Western Hemisphere region of the International Planned Parenthood Federation. And she writes a weekly column for Salon.com and blogs for Religion Dispatches. But this is a very peculiar dynamic that we're living through here in the United States with the tyranny of the minority.
Yes.
Trump's down to about 32% now of support, so he's pandering to the 32%. So as he gets less and less popular and more people realize that he's completely incompetent and very dangerous, he throws more of the power of government behind these increasingly zealous minorities.
Exactly. So, and you know, one of the very frightening things about it is that he could win a second term with that minority.
Explain how he could how you could win with 32%.
Well, he won't get 32, he'll get more than 32%, but he won't need a majority, just as he didn't need a majority when he won this time. That 32%, you know, plus a few other conservatives, is located in the majority of is spread out over the majority of the states. The way the Electoral College works, it's based state by state, and so you can win a lot of very conservative states, but still not win a lot of people. And while New York and California have a lot of electoral seats, they don't have enough. We don't have enough to add up to a majority. So, you know, and of course we also don't know what the candidate will look like for the Democrats, whether we'll have some of the kind of splits we had last time. And the party hasn't shown itself, Democratic Party hasn't shown itself to, you know, be the best in the campaigning area. So minorities, you know, our political system is designed in a way where minority opinion can win an election.
Well, he's already, Donald Trump's putting his stamp on the judiciary. He's had a record it's a record number of open court seats at the highest levels, and an anti-abortion zealot just got elevated to the appeals court out of Notre Dame.
Right.
And she's very, very hostile, not just to reproductive rights, but she's also very hostile to LGBTQ rights as well.
Well, so, you know, when we're looking to just go back to the contraceptive mandate for a second, when you if Trump were to, first of all, he will succeed in overturning the contraceptive mandate, which will mean that in many employer insurance plans will not need to cover contraceptives in their policy with no copay by the woman. That and we have seen that that contraceptive mandate has actually led to lower birth rate, lower pregnancy rates, and already we are seeing an effect on the abortion rate. Fewer women, more women can get contraceptives, fewer women become pregnant who do not wish to become pregnant, and abortion rates are going down. At the same time, as he's doing this, we have to keep our mind, our eyes on the question of federal funding for Planned Parenthood, which is another objective of the administration. Just think, if we had no contraceptive mandate and we had no federal funding for contraception for Planned Parenthood, that we will see a significant rise in the abortion rate in this country. And at the same time, I was just looking it up myself, what we are seeing is that the administration, both at the state level and at the federal level, these phony crisis pregnancy services are receiving significant amounts of both state and federal funding. A study that was done through Cosmopolitan magazine showed that between 2012 and 2017, Pennsylvania gave to a false pregnancy center there called Real Alternatives more than $30 million in state and federal funds to support 98 sites in the state of Pennsylvania. And this is replicated in other states. And so, you know, this assault, you know, under the guise of morality on family planning, which is one of the most moral things a woman can do. I mean, if you don't want to become pregnant, if you are not prepared to be a parent, the most moral thing you can do is work to prevent a pregnancy. It's you know, total Orwellian speak at this point in time.
Well, I was watching CNN yesterday, and they interviewed Congressman Trent Franks, a Republican of Arizona. He was behind the 20-week abortion bill that was just passed by the House. And he was ostensibly asked about banning these bump stock assault rifles, that 12 of which the shooter in Las Vegas had. He had 12 of these bump stock, and that was why he's able to rain down all those bullets on the people at the concert. And this man, this Republican, this overtly, aggressively Christian Republican, kept lying. He kept saying, "No, no, he didn't have," because he didn't want to. He didn't want to ban. He doesn't want to ban anything because he's an NRA. He's in the pocket of the NRA, and he kept lying, saying that no, the guy had machine guns. He had machine guns that are banned under a 1986 law. So it's the NRA talking point. That we don't need new laws, we just need to enforce old ones.
Enforce the ones we have.
Right. And he was completely and absolutely lying. But then he segued from talking about how this horrible man, this horrible killer, he's also a part of the broader cultural decline in America with abortion. So he equated abortion with murdering those people, and he kept hammering away at that, and of course lying about the bump stocks because he doesn't want to be forced, even though the NRA itself has decided to cut its losses and get behind banning bump stocks. So I was just I almost kicked in the TV. I got so angry at this lying Christian. I can't stand these lying Christians.
No, it's true. I mean, I heard this morning, you know, now the line is there is a backing off of a bit from the let's have a law that bans the bump stocks. we just need to clarify that the current law would permit that. And then I heard one of the senators on one of the morning programs today saying that, well, the ATF should take care of this. We don't need to do anything about this. The ATF just has to say that they're already covered. And in fact, that's another lie. It's not true. The ATF doesn't have the authority to interpret the law. That can only be done by the Congress. So, you know, we're dealing on every level with one lie after another in the service of things that are really causing the lives of people.
Well, Frances Kissling, it's a very, very amazing situation. As I mentioned, the less popular Trump becomes, the more power he throws the weight of the his administration behind
right.
a shrinking minority of
yes.
right-wing and far right-wing zealots in this country,
yeah.
and they're getting all the rewards. And I don't understand how you could have that mechanism. And I guess we can only hope that you know Newton's law comes in. For every action, there's an
yeah.
equal and opposite reaction.
And of course, the one of the other very disturbing things about this is that even Republicans who are somewhat moderate and certainly not as hell-bent on the things that Trump is hell-bent on will stand behind him, because it does permit them to do other things that are important to them, whether it's a tax policy that it penalizes the poor or various immigration policies. In all of those areas where they have felt their hands have been tied up to now because of Obama in the last 8 years, they now feel that, you know, they have this, excuse me, Tillerson, I'll go with Tillerson, moron in the White House, and that they can therefore do whatever they want in the Congress, and he'll just... acquiesce to whatever they want. So it's a very dangerous time for our country.
Right. Of course, they have the power to impeach him. So they've got him.
Yes, they could impeach him, but they don't want to impeach him.
No.
They want him right where he is.
Right. Exactly. Well, I thank you very much for joining us.
All right. A little vent on Sunday morning is good for everybody.
Okay.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Frances Kissling, feminist activist and the former president of Catholics for Choice. She's currently a visiting scholar at the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania and serves on the advisory boards of the Journal of Feminist Ethics and the Women's Bioethics Project, and is a consultant to the Western Hemisphere region of the International Planned Parenthood Federation. And she writes a weekly column for Salon.com and blogs at Religion Dispatch. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.